Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Daniel Handler's new book, All the Dirty Parts, is, in his own words, a novel about a young man awash in his own erotic drives and the unceasing sexuality of modern culture, falling for a girl who pursues her own pleasure as fiercely as he does. The opening line comes from the narrator and main character, Cole, a sex-obsessed teenage boy. Cole says, quote, "Let me put it this way. This is how much I think about sex. Draw a number line with zero is, you never think about sex, and 10 is, it's all you think about. And while you're drawing the line, I am thinking about sex," end quote. The book is an unflinching first-person narrative that exposes the internal world of a hyper-hormonal teen awash in porn and his sexual exploits that does not sugarcoat his thoughts or eventual consequences. Daniel Handler is the author of 6 novels. You might know him by his other name, Lemony Snicket, the author of the series of Unfortunate Events books. His books have sold more than 70 million copies and have been translated into 40 languages. Daniel Handler's first play, Imaginary Comforts, or The Story of the Ghost of the Dead Rabbit, runs through November 19th at Berkeley Rep. He's also doing a couple of events next month. On November 2nd, he and his wife, Lisa Bloom, an author and an illustrator, will talk about their latest book, which sounds very sweet, The Goldfish Ghost. That'll be at 7:30 at Green Apple Books on 9th Street in San Francisco. And Daniel Handler joins me in studio. Hi, Daniel.
Hi there.
Hi, Lemony.
Hello.
nice
My wife's
to have
name
you.
Is Lisa Brown.
Brown, so I'm sorry. Thank
it's
you.
It's quite all right.
Sorry, Lisa.
It's just Lisa Bloom is the name of my mistress, and I don't like to get them confused.
Sorry, Lisa. She looks like an amazing illustrator.
She is. Yes, she's much better than that Lisa Bloom woman. I don't know what we're talking about there. She is. She's a wonderful illustrator. And I love her very much. I don't know what to say. We have collaborated on several books and a child.
I read that.
Yeah.
Well, and how old is your child?
He will be 14 shortly.
Oh, okay. So he is right at that stage where parents talk to their kids or should talk to their kids about sex.
I started talking about sex with my son a long time ago to ease into the mortification factor was the idea. But what he is, what I thought you were going to say, he's at the prime age for mortification that his son has published a book about sex. It took my publishers a while to decide whether or not this book could be published for young people, so the book is coming out a little later than originally thought, and a casualty is my son's constant embarrassment.
Has he read it?
He has read some of it, he's told me. But I just think it's not really the book itself as much as it is that his father has written a book about sex, and his friends know that his father's written a book about sex, and he's permanently mortified.
Right.
And I'm sure grateful that I'm discussing him on the radio.
Right. And well, and now you're doing interviews about sex. I mean, when we...
Right. What could be worse?
When we decided to have you on, of course, I went into reporter mode and thought, oh, wait, I read a piece about how the STD rate is so high in the U.S., which isn't getting much attention. And I thought, I want to bring that up with you because it's a very... very important issue that deserves so much more attention.
Well, we're terrified of talking about it. And in my field of literature for young people, sex is the most policed, the most paranoiacally policed content that there can be. It was just recently banned Books Week. They published the list of the most challenged books. And 9 out of 10 of them were challenged for sexuality. And when you look at the sexuality that is portrayed in those books, it's nothing at all. It's nothing that you would call a sex scene. It's nothing titillating, let alone pornographic. Not that I personally think there's anything wrong with something titillating or pornographic in a book for teenagers. But I think that the paranoia about sexual content has had drastically clear results in the culture that... we don't know how to speak openly and honestly about sexuality to young people, and so they're figuring it out for themselves in a highly eroticized, explicit culture. And here we are.
Here we are. You have said in interviews that when you have book events, the audience is usually about half men and boys, half girls and women. But when you did an event for your book, Why We Broke Up, which is about love and breaking up, you were really struck because 95% of the audience were young women.
Yes. Well, there's a very well-documented gender gap in reading, particularly reading for pleasure. in which girls are reading more and at a higher skill rate than young men. And it has a lot of other factors attached to it. Unsurprisingly, it has a lot to do with class and race as well. But there's a very distinct gender gap there. And one of the frustrations of writing for young people is seeing this gender gap and then seeing sexual content being the most policed thing. And so there's something we know that teenage boys are interested in, not that teenage girls aren't. And there's something that we keep out of the literature for teenagers, and then we are wondering why the people who are interested in a thing that can't find the thing in the literature aren't reading the literature. It drives me occasionally to drink.
Well, it also drove you to reread some of your favorite novels from when you were a teenager, and I understand that a lot of those books included sex.
Yes. Well, because I am a man, it's true, who writes for young people, I get asked a lot to give a speech or a workshop on encouraging young men to read. And I've never been very good at those speeches and workshops because I was a voracious reader as a child. So I don't actually have any access to why I would have been turned off from reading and what could lure me back in. But before one of these speeches, I reread a bunch of novels that were my favorite books from about age 16, 17 to age 20, maybe. And I was a very serious reader, and these were very serious works of literature, but they were all filthy. The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love by Oscar Wilde is filthy. The Unbearable Lightness of Being by Milan Kundera is filthy. The Diaries of a Naisnian, well, everybody knows those are filthy. But there was so much literature that I was reading, and it's not pornography, and it was not being used as such by me, but it was very sexual and unabashed about exploring human sexuality. And that's something that we don't see at all in the literature that we're offering young people.
You take part in so many events for writers. You and your wife have a lot of friends who are writers, fiction and nonfiction.
It's true.
So what happened when you looked for books that were honestly talking about the sexuality of boys and young men?
Well, books for young people, there is really hardly any. When you read, for instance, some of the sexier books by Judy Blume, they're still shocking, and there's still a sense that they could not be published right now under the current climate. Yeah. We have very conservative gatekeepers of literature for young people, and it's coming from kind of both political angles. There's still a large right-wing paranoia about sexuality, particularly queer sexuality and even interracial sexuality, which is like enough to make you bang your head on the handsome new tables here at KALW. But there is also a left-wing contingency worried from a progressive point of view about stereotypical or insulting or objectifying portraits of sexuality. And I mean, I think those concerns are super valid. We live in a misogynist culture. It's certainly understanding that we want to present the next generation with a more feminist worldview. I just don't think that cutting out sexuality is particularly a feminist worldview. And I think in particular, the way young male sexuality is portrayed is really reductive. We have kind of bumbling, neurotic comic boys who don't know how to buy condoms and don't know what to do with girls. And then we have predatory monsters who are the villains in countless YA novels. But we don't have the large slice of most of the population of boys who are trying to have some sex and having a little sex and having feelings about it and living like normal people do with sexuality in their lives. Mm. And it's disheartening.
Can you tell us more about what you call these conservative gatekeepers? And also, how has this really changed? You've been writing books since 1999.
Yeah.
How has this changed since then?
Well, I'm not sure that the network of the gatekeeping has really changed that much. It's just, as with the history of all culture, what seems like canon now, what seems like very acceptable, was often the subject of much hysterical debate. And I am amazed and somewhat saddened to learn that I'm old enough to have experienced an entire cycle or two of this myself. But young adult literature and literature for children is overseen by networks of librarians and educators who are all very passionately engaged with the material and a vision of what we want to present to children. And but about sexuality, there's a great deal of paranoia about it. And as a result, there are publishing houses who are making much more conservative choices about what kind of sexuality can be portrayed and how that's going on. And I like to talk about it more in terms of what it is for the industry and what it is for young readers, because in the example of my book, I'm a high-profile enough author that it doesn't really matter to me much whether this book is actually being marketed as a young adult novel or being marketed as a novel. I have the luxury and the privilege to be able to go across the street to some other publishing house and say, hey, we've worked together. Why don't we work together on this book? But I hear from a lot of authors who are trying to portray adolescence and who are having the sexuality excised from their books. Mm-hmm. And it is the more marginalized voice, the more paranoically that is watched. And so I just was at a festival a couple of days ago. I met a young Muslim author who was trying to write about issues of sexuality and abuse within the Muslim American community. And the publisher is very interested in having that voice be a cultural ambassador of goodwill and not a voice that presents a kind of complicated picture of sexuality and misogyny when cultures bump up against together, including, of course, a white American culture. And it's just really sad to see authors in that position and books in that position that are not ending up in the hands of readers who really need them, because we're so worried about what will happen when they read them.
It is so needed, because when you think about what we have access to today, I mean, when I was young, I remember going with my best guy friend to Safeway, and he would grab the Playboy and put it behind an auto car magazine and flip through the pages.
Yeah.
And it was tasteful. It was like women with towels over their shoulders and a rose in their hair.
Yeah.
Right? But he tells me,
I don't know if that's tasteful,
well,
but
compared to what's out there now,
yes,
right?
Tame, I will give you. But yeah.
He tells me what he finds today. I mean, it's 1,000 times worse if you have not seen it, 1,000 times worse than you think it is. And it's with one click of a button.
Well, I mean, most first world teenagers have a device in their pocket that has basically the entire history of pornography available. And in developing this book, I talked to a lot of young people and a lot of people who talk to a lot of young people. And for many people, the viewing of pornography is omnipresent. Mm. And so it's not just kind of the type of pornography and the ease of getting it, but it's that because of the ease of getting it, it's not something furtive. It's not something that you go on a long adventure to find. And there's certainly downsides of there being a long adventure to find pictures that might satiate your curiosity about sexuality. But I think there's also a concern. I talked to two young men who attended a boys' boarding school, and I said, how much were you watching pornography on your kind of all-male hallway where you were living? And it was the wrong question, because watching pornography was not the word for it. The word for it was on everyone's screen all the time were pornographic images playing. Mm. So it's kind of like, how many cars do you see on the way to work or something? It just isn't something that they could fathom. They said it was on, except when you were sleeping, and sometimes then. And, you know, sometimes if some supervisory adult came by, everybody put a new window up on their screen, but that it was a constant background. It was like pop music, is how one of them said it. And I think particularly as a San Franciscan, to see a narrative of liberation that's come with sexuality, that in being more open about it and being more explicit about it, many people who previously felt unwelcome in the world or only in a few square blocks of San Francisco now feel welcome more places. But it's hard to argue that omnipresent pornography is, on the whole, going to be a positive effect on someone.
You did a lot of research for this book.
I did.
You ride buses.
I see it. The radio host always gets a little smirky when we talk about pornography and then says, and you did a little research for this book.
Well, it's so important, because the point you make about liberals and the left not really wanting to have an open, honest conversation about porn because it might go down that censorship path is really important. And a number of studies about what happens when young people are exposed to porn, as you said, constantly, have come out in the last couple of years. There was this one study from the Middlesex University And they quoted a number of girls and boys. A 13-year-old boy said, "One of my friends has started treating women like he sees on the videos. Not major, just a slap here or there."
Right.
This is why we need to talk about this. One of many reasons.
Yes. And I think there's also, I mean, I think there's that line of inquiry. I also think there's a line of inquiry in which we're saying, well, we, in order not to talk about it, we make it super shameful, or to also say that the objectification of women in pornographic culture is such that we don't see any place for it in adolescence life. We don't think there's any proper place for it, which I think is of shame too. I mean, I think that we don't feel that way about any other kind of culture. We don't say, I don't want my son to watch Godzilla movies because I'm afraid he'll think that Tokyo is constantly being destroyed by a giant lizard, or that there'll always be a monster rising up. And we don't say, he better not watch Star Wars because that's not really how outer space travel works. But I think that we do have a paranoia of pornography is so bad, there's no way you can have some kind of adventure with it that might be pleasurable, might be good for you. And so I think on one hand, we do see a very corrosive influence of misogyny and violence from constant exposure to pornography. I also think that we cut short the adventure and the release that's found by pornography in young people.
Today, we're speaking with Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket, about his new novel, All the Dirty Parts. It's about Cole, a sex-obsessed teenage boy. It's a first-person narrative that exposes the internal world of a hyper-hormonal teen awash in porn and his sexual exploits. It does not sugarcoat his thoughts at all or the eventual consequences. And if you'd like to join us, if you have read this book, what were your reactions? What are your thoughts about why we don't spend more time in a culture that is awash in porn and daily sexual images, whether it's walking down the street, seeing one of those, you know, Victoria's Secrets ads or something, or just watching TV? Why don't we talk more about this at a time when we have the highest ever number of STDs recorded in the United States? We'll talk about this also later in the show. What are your thoughts on this? 866-798-8255. Daniel has a young boy who's 14. If you have children, when are you talking to them about these issues? And what are your thoughts about Daniel's experience when he looked for young adult fiction that honestly tackled these issues and really couldn't find it? Part of the problem is because of what he calls conservative gatekeepers when you're looking at who makes decisions about what gets published. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org, tweet us at yourcallradio, or leave a comment on our website. You can find today's show at yourcallradio.org. Let's talk about Cole, a sex-obsessed teenage boy. How
that might be redundant, that phrase that you just said.
That's true. Talk about how he came to you. And I mean, it's so interesting because I was reading the book and there are some parts that are kind of like, oh, I mean, you just don't read. This is, some of it is pretty in your face. There are some other,
literally in some cases, yes.
Some other parts where it's kind of like, oh yeah, he's this sweet kid trying to figure things out. On the other hand, I'm thinking, I don't want my niece to meet a guy like this.
Right. Well, she probably already has. But I think the idea for the book to me came from, I had a dinner party, and a friend of mine who is a man, married to a man, was telling me that he was going to visit his hometown, a small town. And I said, what do you do there in that small town? As an urban snob, I asked. And he said, I like to catch up with my ex-boyfriends and their wives. And he then began to describe an adolescence and a young adulthood that was made up of romantic and sexual encounters between young men that really slipped through any kind of boundaries that we were trying to put on them. And they slipped both through a boundary, a narrative of kind of closetedness and bisexuality, and also a barrier of that someone was being used for something or anything like that. And it was very fascinating to me. And I started to think about that, and I started to think about that as kind of a rejoinder to a lot of queer literature that's published for young people that's extremely romantic. And that I think it's wonderful, obviously, to have more visibility about that. And I think those stories, to have stories that are not about sexuality, that are about queerness, is very powerful because queerness has been so over-sexualized in our phobic culture. I also think that a book about a boy who asks another boy to the prom and they kiss at the end of the evening is not a particularly realistic book about sexual encounters between young men in high school. And so I got... That was the first kind of shot of being interested in that, was thinking about those fluid experiences between boys. And then because books are written by writers... Write that one down if you don't remember. Books are written by writers. There are so many portrayals of adolescence in literature are very sensitive, bookish shorts. It's very precocious people. It's often people who are somewhat outsiders in the community who are nevertheless very literary or very immersed in culture. And I've written some of those books, and I admire some of those portrayals. But there's a whole swath of adolescence that's hardly portrayed in literature, and one of them to me was the boy that you see in high school who's obviously having a lot of sex, and that the way in which his reputation is somewhere between sleazy and admirable, the way the survivors of encounters with him are somewhere between victims of manipulation and just innocent people, and to the extent that his sexual partners cannot always admit to having a really fun time because of the shame surrounding it, and kind of all these narratives that are put on those. And so I got interested in that and started thinking about those boys, and Cole came out of there. Mm.
And as you said, it's so easy to write a book like this that could come out sort of cliche, or boy meets pretty girl but sleeps with five other girls.
Yeah.
And you definitely... I'm assuming, wanted to kind of bash those stereotypes, or at least take them on.
I did. He sleeps with a lot of girls, but he is struggling with what his... if there are consequences or if there's emotional baggage that are inevitable in those encounters. And sometimes it seems like everybody's having a good time, and sometimes it seems like it isn't. And we see that he's viewing a lot of pornography. He's sharing porn links with a friend of his, which was an activity between young men that I was unaware of, and so I started exploring this novel. And we see the way in which the sexualized culture is kind of battling with his own moral conscience in what he's doing. And then after he slept with a number of girls, he ends up in a sexual relationship with his best friend, who is a boy. There would be a temptation to believe that the narrative would say, oh, he's finally figured himself out and this is what it was all along, but that is not necessarily the case. And then he meets a girl who's very forthright and frank about her own sexual desire and very open about her own needs and wants. And that also seems like a kind of paradise and also a narrative that we know where it's going. And then it gets messy, as it does in high school.
What else were you unaware of when you were doing the research for this?
Well... what I really was ignorant of was the just the very open and explicit, in all meanings of the word, communication between young people versus my own adolescence. And part of that is that I grew up in a different time, and part of that is also that I'm very slow on the digital revolution. I still have no smartphone. I'm not engaged in the... mostly, I now have now that my son has an iPhone, I have an iPad so that I may communicate with him in his preferred mode. And that's it's only been a few weeks now that I've been communicating in the kind of communication that most people are using, and that certainly young people are using all the time. And when I think about when I was an adolescent, how I would reach out for individual communication with another adolescent if I weren't just sitting next to them in class, it feels like a sci-fi novel, right? We had to call a building where we thought the other person would be, and a phone would ring in that building and would probably not be picked up by the person you were asking for, so you would hang up, hoping that it was the universal signal to the other adolescent that they should pick up the phone when you called right back. But sometimes it wasn't, and you had to talk to someone in their family. And even with the most lax parenting or the most openness, your conversation was somehow monitored. And it meant that your communication was less immediate and more stilted. And, you know, the way in which when I was in high school, you would ask another high school student to take off their clothes was extremely delicate and maybe impossible. And now, as we know, through digital communication, many young people are taking off their clothes for one another very quickly and anonymously. And I think we can, the downside is very obvious and the good side may not be, but just that difference in communication, that explicitness, the way that you, that when you're texting, exactly what's on your brain is going out onto the screen, which is very different from a note you might pass to someone or a conversation that you might have on the phone when you've been granted entry to this person. And that's a big difference to me, and that was interesting to explore.
Today we're speaking with Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket, about his new book, All the Dirty Parts. It tells the story of Cole, a teenage boy consumed by sex. And we're talking today about why Daniel decided to tackle this taboo topic. We'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this issue? It deserves so much more attention at a time when we are awash in porn. It is so easily accessible. Some of these sites say, if you're 18, click here. You click, and then you're in.
Yeah.
It's very easy. So what are your thoughts on this? If you have children, what books are out there that tackle these issues? Daniel had a hard time really finding any. And if you're an educator, how do you tackle these issues in school at a time when everybody's, so many kids are so connected? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up in about 20 minutes, we will check in with Napa to get an update on the fires there. We'll be joined by Terrence Mulligan. He's with the Napa Valley Community Foundation, and they are raising money to ensure that immigrants are taken care of in some ways, but at least it's on the radar screen of a lot of people in Sonoma and Napa, specifically undocumented immigrants. So we'll be checking in on the fires in about 20 minutes. Coming up tomorrow, investigative journalist David K. Johnston will be in studio to talk about taxes and the economy. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. If you have a show idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show, if you have any questions or comments for Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket, we'd love to hear from you. If you have read his new book, All the Dirty Parts, which is about sex, teenage boys. It's a very honest book. We'd love to hear from you. If you have children, how are you tackling these issues? The easy availability of porn, sexual images, the fact that there aren't that many novels about these issues. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw. I should also mention that Daniel's first play, Imaginary Comforts, or The Story of the Ghost of the Dead Rabbit, runs through November 19th at Berkeley Rep. I'll ask him to tell us what that's about a little later in the show. And on November 2nd, Daniel and his wife, Lisa Brown, who's an author and illustrator, will talk about their latest book, The Goldfish Ghost, at 7:30 at Green Apple Books, Inner Sunset, 9th Street in San Francisco. We have a couple of emails from listeners. Rose in Woodside just hung up. We've got an email from Carol who says,
sorry, Rose in Woodside.
Well, actually,
I hope it wasn't an emergency.
No, she just wanted to talk about, and of course, this is a very controversial topic. She wanted to talk about how young girls are sold clothing that is very provocative, and they're now wearing clothing that's very provocative, and they don't realize that it's being sold to sexualize them. And she wants to know why we don't hear more discussions about this.
Well, I think for the same reason we're paranoid to talk about it. It's difficult to talk about. I have too many nieces, and I want them to be able to express themselves in fashion as openly and honestly as they want to, and to be themselves and to depict themselves the way they want to be depicted. Until sometimes I see what some young people are wearing. And then I think, well, never mind that. You're obviously being exploited, and you're an object of this misogynist culture, and you don't know it. You don't know what you're presenting. And I think that's why it's hard to talk about, because it's hard to talk about. Mm. Novel, All the Dirty Parts, is told in very small chapters, and part of that is that is to recreate the feeling that eroticism is in our everyday lives, that something sexual kind of blurts us into the head. And the the ability to incorporate that into our everyday lives can be tough. And I think that with clothing all the time. Mm. You see somebody who's wearing something provocative and you are provoked, whether in one way or another. And to try to fit that in and say, I'm going to take this person seriously, or I'm going to think about them like this. I want to think about the way they're expressing themselves, when they're expressing themselves in such a way that is sexual in nature. It's tough.
Well, thank you for calling in, Rose. I hope you're still listening. Maybe we'll do a show about that issue. It's important to do these shows that are difficult and deserve more attention. We have an email from Daniel, from Sharon, who says, hey, Daniel, it's Sharon.
Hey, Sharon.
Boys are turned off of reading by well-meaning, in quotes, teachers, parents, and librarians. Their choices are denigrated. I always tell parents to let their children choose their own books and then encourage and support those choices.
That's nice. I wouldn't put well-meaning in quotes. They are well-meaning. And I also think that there's a lot of people who would not pick up a book until they get the kind of encouragement from educators and librarians. And I would not want to be seen as deploring the influence that so many of the people have on the culture. I think they're often really scared about sexuality, but I think they often put really wonderful choices in front of people too. And I was in the hands of some wonderful librarians when I was a child. My son has been in the hands of many a child and an educator and an author and a bookseller. I mean, Green Apple Books is the first place where my son was left by himself, where I said, I'm going to do some groceries. You be here in Green Apple Books. And I knew that there were thoughtful people who were guiding his reading choices in a great way. So a lot of well-meaning people are doing great work.
What are you hearing from librarians and teachers about all the dirty parts?
We sent it to many a youth librarian when the book was in galleys, and we got responses which were, thank goodness, I'm so glad, I'm already giving this book to adolescents, and if you tell anybody I said this, I'd quote me on it and use my name, I will never speak to you again. And which was the kind of response that my publisher for young people had been really wary of, and is why the book was not marketed expressly for teenagers. And I mean, it's exactly the kind of reaction that I see. So many queer men have already written me. The book has only been out about a month or so, and I've already got a lot of correspondence from queer men who say, I'm so glad that you're talking about the kind of encounters that are in this book and the kind of explicit sexuality that is kind of separate from any possible romantic relationship that happened with me. It was the only thing that happened, and I get bored of the extremely clean life of adolescent queerness that is being portrayed by so much literature. But they also said, I really hope you won't tell anybody that I wrote you this. So,
wow.
Yeah, there's been a lot of reaction.
What about at events? You have obviously a lot of followers and fans. Are you finding that young people are coming to your events solo, or are parents bringing their kids to your event for this book?
I think there's both. I think that it never really occurred to me, but some of the events for this book have clearly been an opportunity for parents to bring their adolescents and hopefully go out for ice cream afterwards and talk about it. The adolescents, on the whole, don't seem too embarrassed. I think there's something about the cover of literature about saying we're talking about a book and we can talk about these issues of sexuality in the abstract rather than say, hey, look at all this pornography. Which one turns you on? Which would be a too mortifying conversation. But I found that young people can actually talk very comfortably about sex when it's in the abstract and when it's given this kind of cover of a literary discussion, which has been nice.
Well, thank you for those comments. Let's go to Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Robert.
Thank you. You know, I'm curious as to your use of the word porn. It's got a pejorative connotation, and in this topic where you're trying to, in fact, bring out and bring more openness to the topic, it's questionable, and it kind of falls off people's tongues. Calling it porn rather than erotic material is about the same as calling something fiction versus lying, or science fiction as delusional as opposed to visionary.
That is super interesting to me. I guess one reason that we're calling it porn is that so much of the material that we're talking about kind of self-identifies as porn. And to me, I guess, what particularly when I was a young man, the term erotica to me signaled that it was going to be about sex, but I wasn't going to like it. That's what the word erotica meant to me. Mm. It meant it's going to be about sex, but it's not going to be satisfying in that way. It's going to be gossamer in a way that I did not want. But I think that's an interesting thing to bring up. Do you think the long-term pornography is a less objectionable term?
Robert?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And I also think that it's important for you in this show to draw a connection between Harvey Weinstein and this.
Sure.
In other words, how people treat each other. Mm. And while I'm deeply appreciative and thank you for your book for boys, there is none for girls, and most importantly of all, I see nothing going on with trying to have or start the discussions between boys and girls, or men and women for that matter, about how things have changed and how we are responsible to deal with each other as men and women, or for all of the other sexual categories for that matter.
Sure.
That leaves me baffled.
Well, I think all those points to me are well taken. I think for me, when you see something like Harvey Weinstein's behavior, for me, I see a real result of toxic masculinity that has to do with kind of general power and entitlement that we see in our hegemonic culture, but also very specific to sexuality and the kind of power dynamic and the way that's often exploited in our culture. Certainly, I don't think for a minute Harvey Weinstein gets off the hook because dirty things exist. Mm. But I think that certainly adds to it. And I think there's actually, certainly in universities, not always super successfully, I think there's an enormous conversation going on about consent and about those encounters and the ways in which we can legislate them or negotiate them kind of off the books in a way. And I think there's a lot of conversation going on about that. It's a difficult conversation, and it's not always a successful one.
And so much conversation right now about sexual harassment and sexual assault with the hashtag MeToo campaign.
Yes.
I mean, I'm hearing on my Facebook page from some friends, and I didn't even know these stories, good friends, who are sharing stories for the very first time publicly to let people know how pervasive this is. The Sacramento Bee, I think in the LA Times, also has a story about how women in the California State Legislature are talking about how toxic Sacramento is.
Yeah.
So it's across the board.
I mean, to the extent that I've heard it from people and to the extent that I've read about it, I would offhand say that I don't know a woman who has not been sexually harassed in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And that if there's a woman whose history I don't know, I just assume she hasn't told me. I mean, I think that the what I think of with Harvey Weinstein is, to the extent that the only mercy in that story so far is that how high profile he is and how high profile that industry is. Mm-hmm. And that there's a lot of that kind of behavior happening from the assistant manager at a place where people are making a minimum wage job, where there's no one to whom to complain, and there's certainly not going to be a big media outcry about it when it happens. And I think that's what I worry about and what I'm concerned about.
Robert also brought up girls, and Peggy Ornstein blurbed your book, Daniel, All the Dirty Parts, and we had her on a couple of times talking about her really great book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the New Landscape.
She and I were at City Arts and Lectures together on stage having a conversation about this that was a fascinating conversation, and in my mind could have gone on 5 more hours, though I'm sure the audience had better things to do.
Well, I'd love to have you on with Peggy. And also, Robert, a couple years ago we did roundtables with young boys and then young girls about these very issues. A lot of parents called in, said they were horrified by what they were hearing because we let them speak anonymously and so they can speak honestly. But we should do this again.
Sure.
To have these young kids on to talk about these issues. Thank you, Robert. Let's go next to Renee in Mill Valley. Hi, Renee. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Hi. My boys have enjoyed your books. I have 2 boys, age 9 and 12. I'm curious. My 12-year-old son has recently, it's usually when I'm driving the car, when it's you're trying to focus and they don't have to look at you straight in the face when they're saying these comments or asking about things. And, you know, he's recently brought up topics of other boys in his class, what they're seeing and viewing and what they're curious in. And, you know, he has described those things to me. He just asked about he said, I know this boy knows about this sexual act and I know what it is. So I said, what is it then? And he told me, and he's pretty close enough. And he goes, why would people do that to each other? And I just kind of said, well, you know, as people who are ready for intimacy or sex, they may like those things and they may, you know, engage in that. But if people aren't ready for that, then they don't. And he just thought that was the most disgusting thing. So, you know, but I probably my question is, when you're doing the research of your book, how do you go, you know, did you find any conversation in regards to having that balance? Because I find that technology can be very difficult and there's a whole lot of access that children have, and obviously some parents govern that a little differently than other parents, and yet I still want to be engaged in those conversations and have those conversations with them and let sex be a good conversation. But yet, if a child's not ready for it yet, then you know, there's that balance, and just wondering if you came across that balance at all or those conversations when you're researching your book.
Well, gosh, all the time. I mean, I come across that balance more in being a father than I do of being a novelist. But
I'm sure.
You know, it's the only thing that I tried to, I started the conversation with my son about sexuality very young, and I assured him that we were both going to be mortified all the time while having these conversations, which seemed contrary to what I was told all the time, that people would say, there's nothing embarrassing about it, and tell your child there's nothing embarrassing about it. And I thought, I can't lie, there's something embarrassing about it. You can't talk about extreme bodily issues or close physical intimacy or something that might be sexually arousing to you. That's going to be embarrassing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you talk about it with the people closest in your life, maybe after a couple rounds of drinks, and to pretend that it's not going to be embarrassing to talk to your 11-year-old about erotica is it would just be a lie. So it's I mean, you just have to keep on talking. I think my son has grown up in a household in which we acknowledge the bewildering mystery of just about everything. And sexuality is not something that you settle on when you're a grown-up. You haven't figured it all out. You haven't figured out what excites you and what repulses you and why those might be the close thing. You haven't figured out the way in which the romantic and emotional entanglements of sexuality are so fulfilling and the ways that they can be really irritating and the ways in which you can make your way in a culture that is so explicit and so misogynist and so homophobic, but also to find a lot of joy and delight in it. And I think that to emphasize that life is very mysterious and sexuality is mysterious and you haven't figured it out either, unless you have, Renee, in which case, please write a book about it, because I think all of us could use some guidance. But good luck with your sons.
Thank you so much, Renee.
I hope they turn out well.
Thank you, Renee. Before we let you go, Daniel, I wanted you to tell us just quickly about your first play. This must be exciting for you. It just opened.
It is exciting.
Imaginary Comforts. It's running through November 19th at Berkeley Rep.
Yes, it is also about this bewildering world we're in and about the stories we tell one another and how one story can mean different things to different people. So it was, I had the idea for it shortly after my father died, and our rabbi came to talk to us about his death, about his funeral arrangements, and she did such a wonderful, sensitive, and emotionally coherent job of it. But as a narrative person, I began to think, well, what if she'd been really awful at it? And then I'd also noticed that in writing in my calendar that she was coming, instead of the word rabbi, I'd written the word rabbit, which seemed very interesting and hilarious to me. And so Imaginary Comforts is about a rabbi who is bad at it, trying to plan a funeral, and also that she's mistakenly written rabbit on an online dating forum and so ends up on a date with a man who is looking for a rabbit. And as we say in the theater, confusion ensues. So it's mostly a funny play, though. Also, it's about death. And Tony Ciccone, the soon departing, sadly, artistic director of Berkeley Rep, has done a fantastic job. There's a really talented cast. Mary Lee Talkington is plays the rabbi Michael Gorgian, who is who my sister is very excited about because he was a love interest on the show Party of Five back in the day, has taken the stage in the role of Clovis. It's just a wonderful cast overall, and I have loved watching the cast work on it, and I hope people go to see it.
It runs through November 19th at Berkeley Rep. Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket, is out with a new play and a new novel, All the Dirty Parts, which focuses on Cole, a sex-obsessed teenage boy. And you can find more information about Daniel's events, his new play, and his books at yourcallradio.org. Daniel, a.k.a. Lemony, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Coming up after this quick musical break, we'll check in with Terrence Mulligan, president of the Napa Valley Community Foundation, to get an update on the fires in Northern California. Stay tuned. This is Your Call. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And over the next couple of weeks, maybe even months, we will check in with people and communities that have been affected by the horrific fires in Northern California. As you all know, on October 8th, fires swept through Napa, Sonoma, Lake, and Mendocino counties. It was the most destructive fire in our state's history. The death toll is now at 42. About 60 people are still unaccounted for in Sonoma and Napa counties. On Saturday, there were 100,000 evacuees. Now that people are returning home, that number is 30,000. Still a very high number. So many people have lost everything. And joining us to give us an update on what's happening in Napa is Terrence Mulligan, president of the Napa Valley Community Foundation. Hi, Terrence. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Well, thank you for all the work you're doing. I understand that your foundation and organizations that you're connected with are raising money specifically for immigrants and undocumented immigrants. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I'd be happy to. Napa Valley Community Foundation is the place that I work, and we have a disaster relief fund that we stood up last Tuesday on the heels of the fire. Well, frankly, still in the middle of the fire. And one thing that we know, because we were in a position to be helpful after the earthquakes here in 2014, is that different communities are affected in different ways by natural disasters. And we try our best to pay attention to all the residents in Napa and to create as much opportunity in their lives as we can. And so where we are, because we're long in viticulture and hospitality, and 73% of the viticultural labor force is an immigrant labor force, we do a lot of work to support immigrant families, both those that include documented community members and undocumented community members. And the simple truth about a fire or a flood or anything else is when the federal government comes to help, some people don't feel safe engaging those agencies for assistance. Moreover, in some cases, you can't get help if you're an undocumented community member. So in Napa, the fire has produced broadly speaking, two categories of fire victim. There are the obvious ones, people whose homes have burned down. And we think that number is going to be about 400 by the time all is said and done. We've definitely turned a corner on the fires. I think they're at 70, you know, the containment levels on the three big fires are in the 70s and 80s now, this many days later. And there'll be homeowners who have insurance, who have resources to bring to bear on their own recovery, some renters as well. But there's another class of people who've been affected, and that is the hourly workforce in retail, hospitality, and viticulture up here, people who simply have not been paid for the last week or got far fewer hours in the last week, and those are the families that we have a heart to help, and many of them are immigrants, and quite a few are also undocumented residents.
Now, ICE has suspended immigration enforcement operations at evacuation sites and shelters, but undocumented people are still frightened for a very good reason. What are you hearing from the undocumented community?
We are hearing about great levels of concern. I mean, before the disaster, the climate of fear in Napa County was palpable. Mm-hmm. It sort of ran like an electric current through different towns and neighborhoods, and some neighborhoods more than others. And we heard about people reluctant to get the services that they're entitled to or to engage with their kids in school. And because the rhetoric is so so corrosive and so unkind that it's caused people to hunker down. I guess so far with respect to the disaster, I think the good news is at the local assistance center, which is a thing that sort of pops up after a declared disaster, you've got two sides of the room. You have the boys in their blue windbreakers from FEMA and others who are helpful from EDD and the Small Business Administration. And then we have funded a group of deeply trusted, well-connected, culturally competent nonprofits that sit on the other side of the room. And in the last 2 days, 225 undocumented households have come forward through the local assistance center to understand what resources are available with the funding that we've made available there. And that tells me that notwithstanding the climate of fear, that people are finding their way there and feeling safe and comfortable to do so. And I give credit to our leadership in Napa County, the Board of Supervisors, and our elected officials who've really been careful about messaging that the local assistance center is a safe place to come to get the help that your family may need and is eligible to receive.
Well, thank you for the work that you're doing, and we will definitely continue to follow the fires and also this angle. Thank you for joining us, Terrence.
Thank you so much.
Terrence Mulligan is president of the Napa Valley Community Foundation. In the coming weeks, we will definitely bring you the latest on the fires. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.